Chapter 19, Baltimore, 1938. It was 1938, and near Callander, a very special package had arrived at Quintland. It was a crate full of costumes, custom made in Los Angeles for the Dion girls, who had just turned 4 years old. A crew from 20th Century Fox was on its way to film the quintuplets in a new movie, Five of a Kind. It would be their third. Earlier films had caught them in candid acts of daily life, but this one would feature the acting and singing talents of Emily, Cecile, Marie, Yvonne, and Annette. To promote the upcoming film, newspapers teased a picture of the cowgirl outfits they would wear and printed song sheets from one of the tunes from the film, all mixed up. It was one of five scenes they would appear in, and for the first time, audiences would be able to hear their unmistakable French-Canadian accents struggling to pronounce the English lyrics, an endearing effect which only multiplied their appeal. Oliver Dion continued his battle with the Board of Guardians and fought to regain custody of his daughters. As the government sensed public opinion turning against them, they began to make promises of creating a grand house in which the entire Dion family, now numbering 10 children, could live together, a reunion which would make Oliver a very wealthy man. Their popularity had continued to soar throughout the world, and though the girls were completely oblivious, the merchandising fees they commanded had reached millions. Despite frequent odes to relinquishing control, the government would take its time returning the girls to their parents. Another issue had been weighing heavily on Dr. Defoe's mind. Rumors had been circulating that two of the quintuplets had diseased throats, but were not operated on for fear something untoward might happen. Defoe engaged the press and condemned the accusations as false, saying, "There is nothing the matter with the Quinn's tonsils or adenoids." By July, it was clear he had lied. All of the girls had become ill with infected throats. Whether it was diphtheria or not, one can only guess, but Defoe was forced to admit it had, in fact, been a recurring problem, and this particular occurrence was severe enough that Emily was left unconscious for 48 hours. The nurses and others who cared for her feared the worst, and a special mass was conducted at the Sacred Heart Church nearby, where congregants pleaded to God to spare her life. Because it was summer, rumor spread she had come down with polio, an illness from which death had become more common. Thankfully, Emily eventually recovered, and Defoe decided to take no chances. All 10 tonsils and adenoids would come out, a set of procedures performed on a makeshift surgery table directly within their nursery. Defoe wasted no time announcing their splendid conditions after the surgery. The world of adoring Dion fans breathed a sigh of relief, confident the girls had been restored to perfect health. Behind the scenes, concern for Emily began to intensify. After spending 2 days on a Pullman train riding across the southeastern United States, a solemn 5-year-old Donald Triplett and his parents arrived at Dr. Leo Connor's Harriet Lane Clinic in Baltimore, suitcases in hand. They would need to leave him in an unfamiliar place again, this time for 2 weeks in a dormitory setting. Although they hated the stress it would cause him, Donald's parents were desperate. This was the home of the country's foremost pediatric psychiatrist. If he couldn't determine what had happened to their son, it was likely no one would. During his visit, Connor and his staff observed every detail of Donald's behavior, how he spoke, listened, and interacted with others at the facility. His peculiarities were immediately obvious to anyone who worked with him. He wouldn't come when called and had to be led everywhere by hand. He roamed the halls making stereotype movements with his fingers, crossing them about in the air, a behavior now sometimes referred to as stemming. His ability to communicate was seemingly non-existent, a trait made all the more confusing by his incredible ability to recite song lyrics or American presidents from memory. Connor may not have recalled the details of Alfred, the child he had seen 3 years earlier, but if he had consulted his notes, the similarities would have been remarkable. Both children would echo fragments of sentences over and over with no apparent intent for a response. Both had an all-encompassing desire to be alone, free from friends or family, probably the most puzzling behavior of all. 2 weeks later, Donald's parents returned to the Harriet Lane Clinic to meet with Dr. Connor. Mary's heart, filled with anxiety, was nevertheless hopeful that her determined efforts to have her son seen by the most prominent child psychiatrist in the country would pay off. If anyone would be able to crack the code and reach her boy, she knew it would be Dr. Connor. As Connor delivered his pronouncement, Mary's soul was obliterated. The world-famous psychiatrist had no idea what Donald was suffering from and gave her the same diagnosis he'd given to Alfred's mother a few years earlier. From all of his previous cases, his 500-page volume on childhood psychiatry, and consultations with other psychiatrists at the clinic, Dr. Connor could find nothing like it. Alfred and Donald were utterly alone. Mary and her husband gathered up Donald's belongings into his tiny suitcase and left the clinic, dejected. They would make the long train ride home to Forest, Mississippi, knowing the last glimmer of hope for answers had been extinguished. Connor insisted they keep in touch and let him know about any changes to their son's condition, a request Mary would honor with monthly correspondence. Despite being unable to make a diagnosis for Donald, Connor's popularity as the nation's child psychiatrist continued to grow. In what might have been a moment of prophetic wisdom that year, he penned a nationwide editorial called Sound Mind in Safe Home. Within, he pleaded with parents to forget their over-concern for bowel elimination with purgatives, a direct call for the termination of the mercuric medicine which had been so popular amongst doctors for the previous 150 years. And in another fortuitous moment, he petitioned parents that, quote, beating, boogeyman threats, and the custom of locking in a dark closet for punishment may induce strong and disturbing fears, end quote. Although he didn't realize it at the time, both of these concepts might have been playing a significant role in the baffling personalities of the two children he had seen, first Alfred in 1935 and now Donald. After decades in practice, there were dozens of special cases that filled his reports, children with unique sets of behaviors that he would never see again. It is likely he assumed Alfred and Donald would disappear into obscurity like the others, their cases making for nothing more than anecdotal stories of mysterious conditions amongst his colleagues. He would have been wrong. Emboldened by the success of the diphtheria campaigns, manufacturers had another shot waiting in the wings, another toxoid that could be combined with the first in order that children might be protected against not one, but two infections. Unfortunately, for the children that would receive them, it also made liberal use of aluminum.